a guest? Vola seems to be having trouble wrapping her head around it. When he returns, please express my gratitude. Marlowe won't be coming back, I tell her. When we met in Gimmelwald, I told you I'm not like other guests. Marlowe wasn't either. Now he's gone for good. I think of Carol, who died in my arms, Marlowe, who willingly sacrificed his life, all the people the company kidnapped and used in their sick experiment. The rage floods through me. It feels far better than pain. I grasp the amulet that's lying against my chest. There's something I need to do. Can you guarantee my friend's safe passage back to Imra? I ask Vola. Yes, Vola says. Make sure there are viruses at Imra's gates, I tell Kat. Simon, no! Kat shouts. But an instant later, I'm gone.
The Hunt. The Hunt is addictive. I know why the guests love it. You spot your prey, you stalk it, you strategize, then you go in for the kill. Headset players tend to be solitary creatures. Occasionally they'll travel in pairs. Less often you'll encounter a party of three. I have an arsenal of weapons now, and the element of surprise. But whenever possible, I love to kill them the way Arnie would, up close and personal. Nothing compares to the feeling of shoving a dagger into an avatar and feeling the hot, sticky blood on your hands. I've got one in a chokehold now. I found him and two buddies in a fancy tent on the edge of a bombed-out war zone, watching a scantily clad NPC peel off what little was left of her clothing. All three avatars were dressed in black, like ninjas, so I was surprised to hear accents that were pure USA. I sent the first one back to set up with three quick bullets to the back of the head. The second went even quicker. He was already down two lives. When I crashed into the tent, the third one just froze in fear. Real heroes, these guys. I've got his neck clamped in the crook of my elbow, and I'm taking my sweet time. His legs are kicking, arms flailing, back arching. The NPC is still dancing. She's not wearing a stitch at this point, but I couldn't care less. I can't be distracted. I'm in the zone. I swipe the edge of my knife across the man's throat. The cut isn't deep enough to kill him. I watch the blood bubble up from inside.
You shouldn't have come here on your own.
My victim's lips haven't moved. There must be someone else in the tent. I glance up to see a man in an old-fashioned check suit standing over me. With a single thrust to the jugular, I deliver the death blow to my prisoner. He slips from my lap, and his avatar flashes and disappears. When he arrives at the gates of Imra, the virus will dispose of him for good. I've done my duty. I just wish I had more time to savor it.
Leave Otherworld now, the Kishka orders. Let your friends finish this work.
I'm not done, I tell him. There are still killers here. I've been traveling the realms for several Otherworld days. By my count, I've dispatched 732 avatars. I'm sure the viruses have taken down just as many, but that means there could be hundreds of guests left.
Let someone else take over.
No, I tell him. I won't put the others at risk.
You're the one who's at risk, Simon.
It's the first time he's ever called me by my name, and the first time he seemed so serious.
You've lost the plot, son.
What I've done is stopped listening. There's something happening outside the tent. The landscape is shifting. The sand dunes are losing their soft, rounded curves. They're forming right angles and building towers. I hear a car honking and the rumble of a train under my feet. Otherworld and the real world are blending again.
I gotta go,
I tell him.
Go back to New York. Remember who you are.
I didn't want to come here in the first place, I shout. Now shut the hell up and let me finish what I have to do. I send my dagger sailing in the Kishka's direction. He vanishes before it hits. I yank my knife out of the bark of a tree, take the amulet in my hand, and move on. I'm suddenly standing knee-deep in muck. I look all around, I know exactly where I am, but I have no idea why I'm here. This isn't where I asked to go. I grasp the amulet again, but before I can leave, I see them. There are two avatars here, giants with bulging muscles. They've tweaked their camo to better suit their surroundings, but I have no trouble recognizing them. One of them is the avatar Alexei shot the first time I saw him. The other is the guy who was eaten by the beast that lurched out of the water. They're staking out the hut where Alexei's girlfriend lives. They've come back for revenge, and they're planning an ambush. They won't find Alexei today. We still have his headset, and I took back the disc he'd borrowed. But there's no telling what they'll do to the child inside. The door of the hut opens, as if on cue, and the female exits. She's as lovely as the last time I saw her. I watch as the two avatars share a silent look. The smiles on their faces make it clear that they're out for blood. When the child disappears back into the building, they begin to wade toward her. Something stirs in me. Something I haven't felt since I set off on my quest. The situation isn't optimal, but I can't delay. I pull out a gun and send a bullet through one of them. His avatar flashes. Then he turns to face me as the second one dives for cover.
"You must be another friend of the freaks,"
the guest snarls at me. I don't even answer. I just shoot. The avatar disappears, but before I can turn my attention to the next guest, there's a spray of blood and a searing pain in my hand. My gun goes flying and vanishes in the swamp. I've been hit. My right hand has been rendered useless. I'm suddenly exposed. I have no place to hide and no weapon to defend myself, not even my fists. When the next shot comes, I expect to die. Two more shots quickly follow. But I'm still alive. I look up to see that my adversary has vanished. Someone else has eliminated him. A man in gray coveralls steps around the corner of the shack, his weapon out.
"That was close, my friend," Alexei remarks. "What are you doing here?"
I groan. He must have bought a new headset.
"I've come to stay," he says.
He's wearing the same coveralls he always wore, and his hair is parted in exactly the same place. But he seems different somehow.
"Come."
He waves me forward.
"Let's tend to your wound."
I wade to the house and climb up to the porch. When I glance back, I can see the trail of blood I've left in the water. I can only imagine what kind of beast it might attract. I stick close to the wall, away from the railing, as I make my way toward the Russian.
"My dear," he calls into the house, "bring me something to bandage a hand."
Soon, the child emerges with a strip of fabric. She gives Alexei a kiss, all while eyeing me carefully. I've been here before, but she still doesn't like me. The moment Alexei begins wrapping the cloth around my injured hand, she disappears back into the shack they share. "Unless you want your new headset destroyed, you should leave," I tell Alexei. "The virus has been released. There are copies searching for guests throughout Otherworld." I expect him to be furious, but he isn't.
"I'm not wearing a headset."
"Then how..." I start to say.
"I signed over my shares to the company in exchange for a capsule and the debugged disc."
"That's impossible. They couldn't have debugged the disc so quickly."
"They'd already made their breakthrough," Alexei tells me. "But Wayne didn't want to share the information with anyone but me. He called as soon as you left the boardroom."
My heart sinks. I don't know why I feel so betrayed when I should never have trusted Alexei in the first place. If I still had the use of my hand, I'd pummel his face with it. "You didn't even wait for us to bring James Agubu to you?"
"No,"
he admits.
"I was never convinced you could find him. I've had my best investigators searching, and they haven't been able to uncover a trace of the man."
"So you were planning to screw us one way or another," I say. Alexei laughs like it's all a big joke.
"Don't be bitter, my friend. Your efforts will be rewarded. The disc and capsule weren't the only things I requested. I have the young boy you've been trying to rescue. He was delivered to my house. I asked for the other one as well, but I'm afraid..."
"He's dead."
Yes, Alexei confirms. I also procured a copy of the company's latest product, Other Earth, I believe it's called. It's yours, if you want it.
As happy as I am to hear about Gorog, I'm still furious with Alexei. You could have gotten all of that without stabbing us in the back. If you'd just given us enough time, you could have had your disc and taken over the company. Alexei finishes wrapping my hand. He leans back against the railing. I suppose he's not scared of the monsters lurking below.
Do you know how I spent my time while I was waiting for my disc to arrive? I watched the news. Have you noticed that the world has become a very strange place lately?
No kidding. I've been too busy to watch television, I grumble.
There have been several mysterious deaths of late, men discovered in locked rooms or bathroom stalls. If you had connections inside the NYPD, as I do, you'd know there's a detail that's been covered up. The men were all found wearing identical glasses. And there were strange plastic discs on the back of their skulls.
I feel myself shiver, though it's stiflingly hot in the swamp. Other Earth, I say.
Precisely. Would you like to hear my personal theory? I think the company gave these men the product. Perhaps they were men the company wanted to dispose of, or they considered expendable. It would make perfect sense, would it not? The company needed people to test the new Other Earth discs.
But how could the company keep the tests a secret, I ask. The guys who died weren't locked up in capsules. They were out walking the streets of New York.
Yes, they were men with careers and children and wives. I suspect they were using the discs in ways that wouldn't be acceptable to their employers or families. If word got out, they had more to lose than the company did.
You're saying the company has dirt on them?
Certainly, says Alexei. In Russia, we call it kompromat. We never make deals without it.
Why are you telling me this? I ask. What do you care if the company's been killing people? I'm sure Alexei is responsible for more deaths than the disc. It's hard to believe he suddenly located his conscience.
I don't care at all, but I have the first debugged disc, and I don't want anyone else to have one, he says. The truth about Other Earth should help you destroy the company. If the company is destroyed, there will be no more discs. What's good for me is good for everyone.
Of course, everything must meet that first requirement.
But what matters most is that it's good for him. Is that correct, Alexei?
I almost wonder if I've spoken out loud, but the voice has come from behind me.
Fonz.
The Russian smiles as he turns to face his old protege.
Welcome back. All is forgiven.
I see his hand moving toward the gun tucked in his waistband, and I know he's lying. Fonz is the closest thing to a zombie that I've encountered in Otherworld. I have no idea how he made it from Karamojo to the swamp. His wounds haven't been treated. Strips of my cloak are still wrapped around his leg, but they're soaked through with blood. As far as I can tell, he's completely unarmed.
How can all be forgiven?
Fonz asks.
I don't remember forgiving you. You let us all think that you were a hero, but when you had a chance to save the children, you chose to serve yourself first.
And look how everything turned out.
Alexei spreads his arms wide.
Why bicker when we've all gotten what we want? I've just been informed that the virus has been released. The other guests will soon be gone. The children can live in peace and harmony. I promise to be a benevolent god.
I feel my eyebrow lift. That last bit is not going to go over well.
You are not a god,
Fonz spits.
You may be immortal in this world, but you aren't in your own. Someday you will die too, and the children of Otherworld will celebrate.
You are mistaken, my friend. I have conquered death,
Alexei tells him.
My memories have been uploaded into this avatar. Even when my body dies in the world I was born into, I will continue to live in this one.
That's not possible, I blurt out. The tech doesn't exist.
6 months ago, you would have said the same of Otherworld, Alexei tells me.
Fonz limps towards Alexei. I'd love to take a few minutes to think it all through, but the situation here is rapidly deteriorating.
I've made sure that my kind knows the truth about you, Fonz says. I've traveled from wasteland to wasteland, telling all who will listen that you were willing to let us die. No one will worship you, Alexei. You'll be shunned, left alone in this hut to rot.
I hope it's true, but I suspect it isn't. Alexei's jolly laugh indicates that he sees no chance of that happening anytime soon.
I'm afraid you're wrong again, dear Fonz, Alexei informs him. Those who speak out against me will be killed. If I must, I will fill the cages in Karamoja with my enemies. Then I will hunt them down one by one and enjoy myself thoroughly.
Every being in Otherworld will hate you as much as I do, Fonz says.
Alexei sighs.
A god does not need to be loved to be worshipped. He needs only to be all-powerful. I can kill, and yet I cannot be killed. Lesser beings will have no choice but to bow before me. You have the honor of being the first to do so, my friend.
I will never bow down, Fonz says.
Then I will have to force you.
Alexei lifts his gun and shoots 3 times in a row. The sound is so deafening that I can't hear the splash Fonz makes when he falls from the porch into the water below. I dive into the swamp at the spot where I saw him go under. My eyes are open, but I see nothing. My arms sweep through the murky water, and the fingertips of my injured hand brush up against something scaly, something that feels impossibly large. Then it's gone, sending waves through the water that push me into another creature about my size. I take hold of the body and drag it to the surface. It's Fonz, and though I'm almost positive he's dead, I haul his limp carcass over to the ladder that leads up to the porch.
Leave his corpse in the swamp, Alexei orders me.
What? It seems too callous even for a man like Alexei. Fonz loved you and looked up to you. He thought of you as a father and you betrayed him. The least you could do for him is give his body a proper burial.
Why waste the effort? Alexei says. He's computer generated.
And me? What am I?
It's the female child, her voice trembling and her face grim.
Magia.
It's the first time I've heard her name leave Alexei's mouth.
I heard everything, Alexei. Will you hunt me down if you grow bored with me? If I die, will you push me off the dock too?
The guilt on the Russian's face takes me by surprise. It's as though he's been caught committing the worst possible crime. There's justice, even here in Otherworld.
Never, Alexei croaks. I love you. You're the reason I'm here.
I know it's the truth. Why would he lie? If he didn't love her, he could easily trade her for another, but this child is special. Whatever they had, Alexei has just destroyed it.
I don't believe in you anymore, she tells him,
and I realize that she too has a gun in her hand. She lifts it until the muzzle is pointed directly at Alexei's heart.
Magia, he tries to cajole her. This is ridiculous. You can't kill me.
I know, but I will settle for making you suffer.
She fires. I see Alexei fall. I wait for him to get back to his feet, but the seconds tick by, and he still hasn't moved. Finally, I have no choice but to let go of Fonz's corpse. By the time I've climbed the ladder to the porch, his body has been reclaimed by the waters. I find Alexei lying face up on the wooden floor. Magia, pale and heartbroken, has thrown her gun into the swamp and knelt beside Alexei's avatar. I stand over her, silent and dripping. I know something's gone wrong. A trickle of blood is coming from the side of Alexei's mouth. It runs down his cheek and begins to pool on the ground.
He's dying.
Suddenly everything makes sense. The company cheated him. The disc they gave him wasn't safe at all. They knew they were sending Alexei off to his death. Wayne probably handed over Gorog so Alexei would trust him. I'm sure he plans to reclaim his guinea pig once Alexei is gone.
Damn, what a dick move. Even for someone like Wayne.
Magia rests her head against Alexei's chest and tries to hold back the blood that's pouring out of him.
You told me you were immortal, she sobs.
They said I was, Alexei gurgles. They told me I'd feel things, but I wouldn't be able to die.
I close my eyes. I can't bear to see any more. He believed the company. He swallowed all their bullshit, hook, line, and sinker. One of the most notorious men in the world heard exactly what he wanted to hear and believed every word of it. There's suddenly no doubt in my mind. Alexei Semenov is not long for this world, or any other. I kneel down beside the wounded avatar. Just in case something happens to you, what should I do? I don't want to insult him while he's on the verge of death, but I feel it's my duty to ask. Alexei's head rolls to the side. When he coughs, the blood splatters the floor beside him. He wipes his lips with his fingers and holds them up where he can see. He must have watched men die before. I'm sure he knows exactly what that means.
A man in my position must be prepared for any outcome, he tells me. Go to my house. Tell my men you've come for your things. They'll know what I left for you. Use my gifts well. Make the company pay for what they've done.
Reunion. My hand looks normal to the naked eye, but it's as useless in New York City as it was in Otherworld. I doubt it was my injury that made my friends insist that I couldn't return. I think they saw, in my eyes, that real damage had been done. I'm not sure I'm getting much better. Whatever darkness was inside me in Otherworld is still there. I can feel it, slithering through my veins and coiling around my organs like a serpent. At first, Kat refused to leave me, but the others convinced her there was no other choice. She and Elvis had to go back to Otherworld to finish the job I started, the job I failed to complete. I reminded them that they'd first have to free Elvis's avatar. Cutting it out of the web the spider child used to immobilize him couldn't have been easy, but there are no easy jobs to be had these days. I'm obviously in no condition to visit Alexei Semenov's house, but I have to retrieve my inheritance. Busara wanted to come with me, but I refused to allow it. I shouted at her, which, I'll admit, wasn't necessary. I couldn't stop myself. I've just come back from a world where I could kill anyone who challenged me. I don't know how long it will be before I'm human again. In fact, I'm starting to worry I'll be stuck this way. Maybe I'm like that dude from The Fly. I got into the wrong machine and now I'm transforming into a monster. Once I tamped down my temper, I tried to explain to Busara that I have no idea what to expect when I get to Alexei's. If the Russians set me up, she and I would both be goners. With my good hand out of commission, I'm unable to defend myself, and Busara is nobody's idea of a bodyguard. It's best if only one of us dies. My cab drops me off on the corner of 70th Street and Madison Avenue. I try to keep my head down as I walk the rest of the way to Alexei's townhouse. Whenever I look up, I see things I don't want to see. The gate to the service entrance is locked, so I ring the bell beside the carved wooden doors, and a cordial man in a plain black suit greets me. He's not one of the tough guys I saw during my first visit to the mansion. If I had to guess, I'd peg him as an accountant or a statistics professor. Hundreds of washings have turned his once white shirt a drab cream color. And unlike the men I met last time I was here, he doesn't look like he's ever popped a steroid.
Mr. Ethan,
he asks in a Russian accent. I answer with a nod.
Welcome. I've been expecting you. Please, follow this way.
This time I'm allowed in through the main entrance. I guess the sanitary precautions are no longer necessary now that Alexei Semenov is gone. I'm sure the irony isn't lost on anyone here. Alexei managed to survive a poisoning and an acid attack, only to lose his life playing a video game. Alexei's men are still here, lurking like ghosts. There must be a dozen of them, yet the house is eerily silent. My guide leads me deep into the mansion, past palatial chambers, and a wood-paneled library with shelves that circle a central atrium. We stop outside a room that's the size of a walk-in closet. A single capsule takes up most of the floor space. It's a rectangular box around 7 feet long and 3 feet high. A hexagonal glass door offers a view of the stainless steel interior, which has just enough space to fit a reclining human.
"This is where Alexei died," the man announces. "In that miserable box."
I hear the sadness in his voice, and I suddenly see something I missed.
"You're a relative."
They look nothing alike, but those icy blue eyes could only have come from the same gene pool. My suspicions are confirmed with a single brusque nod.
"His brother. I arrived in New York this morning."
"I'm sorry for your loss," I say, and immediately regret it. I apologized to Alexei once, and he took offense. The man stares at the capsule. He doesn't want to meet my eye.
"Alexei was not a good man. It was always just a matter of time," he says. "Converte gladium tuum in locum suum. Omnes enim qui excepperunt gladium, gladio perabunt."
"I'm sorry, I don't understand Latin," I tell him.
"I believe in English it is most often translated as, 'Those who live by the sword will die by the sword.'"
I wouldn't have imagined Alexei Semenov's brother would be the sort to go around dropping quotes in dead languages. "Are you a professor?" I ask.
"I am a priest," he says,
moving on before I have a chance to pick my jaw off the floor.
"It seems my brother left very clear instructions about what to do in the event of his death. You are meant to play a key role. I brought you here to this room so you could see how Alexei's life ended. If you don't mind, I would like to show you how it began."
He reaches into the pocket of his suit and produces a photograph, which he glances at and then passes to me. The paper is square and the image faded. It was taken by the kind of camera that hasn't been manufactured in decades. There are two barely teenaged boys in the picture, standing outside a rickety wooden cottage. They can't be more than a year apart in age. Their arms are around each other's shoulders, and they're beaming at the camera.
"That is the Alexei I choose to remember," the priest says. "The one I knew before the money or power. He was the best of all brothers. A few days after that photo was taken, our parents were killed in an accident. Alexei went to work to take care of me while I stayed in school. He was 13 years old. In another life, he would not have grown into the monster he became."
I hand the photo back to the man whose name I don't even know.
"What do you know about my brother's death?" he asks.
I tell him everything. I can't see any reason to hold back.
"So it is true that the company murdered him," Alexei's brother concludes when I finish.
"Yes," I say. "They gave Alexei a disc, though they knew it would eventually kill him."
"Thank you for your honesty, Mr. Eden," he replies. "Do you know what Alexei left for you?"
"A kid," I tell him, "and a pair of glasses and a disc."
"Yes," Alexei's brother says. "Those are all part of the package."
I hear footsteps behind me. I turn to see two figures coming toward us. One, a large man with a pasty complexion. The other is a boy, thin and dark, with a nasty-looking scar on the side of his shaved head. Otherworld wounds don't leave scars. It must have been from the real-world accident that left him comatose. He's wearing what appear to be plaid pajamas. I know his name is Declan, but he'll always be Gorog to me. The boy pauses when he sees me, as though he's trying to figure out if I'm real. Then he rushes right at me and throws his arms around my chest like a child. After a while, he straightens up and steps back. His body has recovered, but I can tell how much he's suffered at the company's hands. His eyes are hollow, and his ashen face is so gaunt that I can see the skull beneath his skin.
I have to grit my teeth to force the rage back down inside me.
"Thank you, Simon," he says. "I always said you were the one."
Jeez, that again. I force a laugh. I'm not the one. I'm pretty sure the one would have rescued you sooner. Alexei's brother gestures to the larger man. He comes forward with a duffel bag, which he holds out to me. At first, I assume it's filled with Gorog's things. Then it dawns on me that Gorog probably doesn't have any things. When I reach for the bag's handles, they slip out of my fingers and it drops to the ground. For an ordinary-sized bag, it's incredibly heavy. I give Alexei's brother a nervous glance. I'm not sure I want to know what's in the bag.
"That one's a surprise, is it?" he asks. "Alexei wanted you to have everything you need to get the job done."
I'm curious as hell, but I won't pull the zipper. I figure I'll wait until we've left to open my present.
"A car is waiting outside," says the brother. "It will take you wherever you need to go. I wish you good luck."
That seems to be all he has to say. "Wait," I call out as he walks away. "Is there a way we can reach you?"
"No," the man says. "Soon all of this will be gone, and I will have vanished along with it."
The car outside is a black Mercedes with a tinted glass panel separating the driver from the back seat. The glass lowers as Gorog and I settle in. "Head toward New Jersey, please," I tell the man behind the wheel. "I'll give you directions once we're out of the tunnel." As soon as we're rolling, I check inside the bag.
"Oh my God,"
Gorog gasps. The bag is filled with stacks of $100 bills. It's not the money that interests me most, though. Sitting on top of the pile of cash is a small box. I crack it open to find a pair of black glasses and a disc inside. Stuck to the disc is a bright pink post-it note. On it is a list of 5 names. I recognize a couple, including the famous movie director who was recently arrested for attacking an actress. Aside from him, these must be the names of men who've died wearing the glasses.
"That's Other Earth,"
Gorog gestures toward the glasses. He's careful not to touch them. When I look at him now, I see a 13-year-old kid who's still waiting for his growth spurt. It's hard to imagine how someone so small and fragile could survive what he's been through. "You know about Other Earth?"
"The engineers at the company made me play it 1,000,000 times. The disc is different. It's not like Otherworld. You stay in this world, and you can move your body, but you feel everything you see through the glasses. They'd hook me up to all kinds of monitors and let a monster loose in the room. Every time it would kill me, they'd do some kind of scan afterward, try to figure out how I was still alive."
"Did it?" I can't finish.
"Hurt?"
Gorog asks.
"Hell yeah, it hurt. You don't know what pain feels like until you've been eaten or ripped apart. But it all went away when the game ended. As soon as the disc was off, I felt fine. They never could understand how I stayed alive."
"When was the last time the company did that to you?" I ask.
"Day before yesterday. A few hours before the Russians came to get me," Gorog says,
which means they haven't given up on debugging the discs. The company is definitely going to want Gorog back. I start to hold the Other Earth glasses up to my face, but Gorog grabs my hand.
"Don't mess with it, Simon," he begs. "It's every bit as bad as Otherworld. With the disc on, it's almost worse."
"I have to understand how it works," I tell him. "Alexei Semenov thought it could help us destroy the company. He was convinced that Other Earth killed people too."
"He was right,"
Gorog says.
"I heard a couple of engineers talking about someone who died. Sounded like a guy who used to work with them. They said he'd gotten hooked, and they were trying to guess what he'd kept going back to Other Earth to see."
"What were some of their guesses?" I ask. Gorog's cheeks flush.
"They were pretty gross," he says. "You know, dirty stuff."
The car emerges from the Lincoln Tunnel and the darkened glass lowers.
"We're in New Jersey, sir," the driver announces. "Where would you like to go?"
"Elizabeth," I say. The name of the town hits Gorog hard.
"What?"
he cries.
Don't tell me you're taking me home.
Not exactly, I say. We're going to get your parents. Then you're leaving New Jersey with them. Give the man your address. Gorog just stares at me like I've broken his heart. Most 13-year-olds in his position would be dying to go home by now, but Gorog obviously wants to stay for the fight. The kid is amazing. Come on, just do it, I tell him. You can argue all you want on the way. Gorog reluctantly gives the driver his address.
Let me go with you,
he pleads as soon as the window goes up again.
I want to destroy the company just as much as you do.
I can't let you. I hold up my injured hand as I tell him. I won't be able to protect you. I can't even protect myself. Gorog crosses his arms.
When we were in Otherworld, you took me with you. That was just as dangerous, but it paid off, didn't it? I saved your life there, and I proved I can take care of myself.
I want to point out that in Otherworld, Gorog was a 7-foot ogre dressed in a loincloth and covered in tribal tattoos. But I know he'll say that he's the same person here that he was back there, and I know I can't argue against him because he'll be right. The boy beside me is a fearless warrior, one to whom I owe my life. I know, Gorog, I tell him. I'm not sending you away for your sake. I'm asking you to go for mine.
What do you mean?
He asks. I'm not well, I tell him. He's the first person I've confided in. I don't know why, but I want to tell him everything. The game has messed me up pretty badly. Carol was the first person I saw die, but she wasn't the last. I'm not sure what will happen to me if I lose another person I care about. I'm already losing my mind.
Carol chose to die because she believed in you,
Gorog says.
She thought you were the one who could stop all this. I believe in you, too.
If that's supposed to make me feel better, it doesn't. Even in my dreams, I know I'm not the one. Look, I don't know how this is all going to end, I admit. But if you're safe, at least I'll know I've done one thing right. We pull up at the address Gorog gave the driver, a tiny row house that's seen better days. The sun is going down and the lights are on. I can see two people making dinner in the kitchen. It's such an ordinary scene that I almost tear up. I never knew you could miss ordinary this badly.
They'll be in danger if I'm with them,
Gorog points out.
The company knows who they are. They'll come searching for me.
They will. And as I think about it, I realize I'm sure that was part of their plan. Alexei dies, they snap Gorog back up. I just hope that the news of Alexei's death hasn't managed to reach them. They'll be in danger either way, I say. I knock on the glass divider, and it lowers. I was told you would drive us wherever we want to go. Is that true?
That was the order, the man confirms.
This kid and his family will tell you what the next stop will be. It's safer this way. Alexei's driver can be trusted. The company will have no way of knowing where Gorog and his family have gone. I unzip the duffel bag and pull out the black box and a wad of bills, which I keep for myself. Take this, I say, shoving the rest of the money toward Gorog. Leave right away. Don't go to any relatives' homes. Don't take any credit cards or phones. Lie low until the company's gone under.
But don't you need the money?
Gorog asks. I do, but even if that bag contained all the money in the world, I'd still make him take it. I'd give him anything I could if it meant he'd be okay. I have enough, I tell him.
Promise you'll come find me when the coast is clear,
Gorog begs. I nod. You have my word.
Then I believe you. Because you're the one.
I don't bother to argue. I just give him a hug, then open the door and slide out. I don't look back until I'm too far away for him to see the tears in my eyes. I watch from across the street as Gorog lugs the duffel bag up a short flight of stairs to the door. He rings the bell, and a woman answers. She teeters for a moment, and I'm worried she'll faint. Then she calls out to someone inside the house, grabs her son, and pulls him toward her. Gorog's father appears, every inch as tall as his son once described him. The three are still standing there, bawling, when I walk away. I hail a cab a few blocks from Gorog's house. In Manhattan, you don't find many cabs with protective plexiglass barriers between the front and back seat these days, but apparently they're still necessary in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The driver laughs when I tell him I'm going to the Waldorf Astoria, and I have to flash a few bills to convince him I'm serious. We're on the New Jersey Turnpike, and the car has come to a stop. I can see flashing lights about a mile away. There's an accident directly in front of us, and no exit ramp in between. On the other side of the Hudson River lies Manhattan, just close enough to tantalize. There's no telling how long we'll be stuck. It's funny. I can't even remember the last time I was bored. I've almost forgotten what it feels like. Even before Otherworld, I always had a smartphone in my pocket that could keep me company. Now, it's just me and the driver up front. It's strange to have nothing to look at and no one to kill. I open the black box that's still sitting in my lap and take out the rather ordinary black glasses inside. I put them on. Just for a second, I tell myself, though without the disc, they should be harmless. A menu appears in front of my eyes. It's what looks like a list of games. They seem silly and innocent. I scroll through the options and choose Goliath. A weapon icon pops up in the upper right corner of my vision. To my civilian eye, it looks like an anti-aircraft gun. I position my arms the way I imagine you'd hold it, and the life-size weapon is suddenly in front of me. I can't feel it, of course, but it responds to my movements. It's pretty impressive, but I'm still not sure what I'm supposed to shoot. Then, I hear a roar in my ears. An explosion follows soon after. My body doesn't sense the tremor that accompanies it, but I see my surroundings shake. I turn to the window and realize the island of Manhattan is under attack. A reptilian monster that looks different enough from Godzilla to avoid copyright disputes is laying waste to the city. I feel myself flinch as it rips off the top half of the Empire State Building and hurls it into the Hudson. A red warning flashes in front of me. Damage detected, 2%. I assume the object of the game is to minimize the destruction. Narrowing my eyes lets me zoom in on the beast as it snatches an airplane out of the sky and crushes it in its claw. The detail is magnificent, every bit as good as Otherworld. I roll down my window, raise my weapon, and position the monster in its crosshairs. My right hand is still in a lot of pain, so I pull the trigger with my left. When I fire, a small missile blasts from the barrel and streaks across the sky. I lose track of it over the river, but the ball of fire that bursts from the beast's shoulder tells me I hit my mark. It roars and searches for its assailant. It can't see me, but it knows I'm somewhere to the west, and it starts to stomp in my direction.
"Hey, you okay back there?"
I hear someone ask. I turn to see the driver staring at me in the rearview mirror. "Yeah," I tap my glasses with an index finger. "I'm just playing a game."
"Sure you are,"
the driver replies warily, looking very thankful for the plastic barrier between us. I figure there's only one way back to the home menu. I close my eyes. When the sound of the game fades, I open them again. The menu is in front of me, and I choose Future World. Instantly, the city as I've always known it vanishes. It's replaced by soaring buildings that reach far beyond the clouds. Flying vehicles maneuver around them. The cars alongside me are now unrecognizable forms of transportation. The people inside them don't appear to be people at all, but rather a variety of alien life forms. The next time I pick Dystopia. The glittering city is replaced by one that was destroyed long ago. It's your typical Hollywood wasteland, the one we've all seen a million times. The skyscrapers have crumbled, bridges have plunged into the waters below. A dusty haze smothers the land. The cars around me are rusted out wrecks, nothing left of the humans that once drove them. My own car is now just a metal frame with no doors or windows. I hear a loud thump on the roof, and my eyes turn upward. When I look back down, I find I'm surrounded by snarling beasts that resemble giant versions of the wild dogs that prowl the woods around my hometown. I have a weapon, but I don't choose to use it. I sit back while they maul me. I see my own blood pooling around my feet, but I feel nothing at all. The game shuts off, the menu returns, and I take off the glasses. If this were Otherworld and I were wearing a disc, I'd be dead. My heart is racing. The experience was realistic enough to leave me breathless. But now I'm back in the real world. Air is still pumping in and out of my lungs. Nothing has changed. I reach into the black box on my lap and I pull out the disc inside. It's a modified version of the one I have. Smaller, but apparently no less deadly. I wouldn't say I've ever been known for making great decisions, but what I'm about to do may be the dumbest of them all. I'm dying to know what else Other Earth has to offer. My friends will never let me test it while my hand is unusable. The back seat of a cab isn't exactly the ideal place for a trial. The driver is already watching me nervously through the rearview mirror. But I don't see a better opportunity headed my way anytime soon. I put on the glasses and affix the disc to the back of my skull. If it weren't for the menu that's appeared, I'd think it wasn't working. I haven't been transported anywhere else. All parts of my body are able to move just fine. Nothing appears to have changed, aside from an all-new menu in front of me. There are two items. The first says simply, Dame Judy. The second says, New Experience. These must be the same glasses I tried at the company. I've already seen enough of Dame Judy, so I pick New Experience. A tablet appears in my hands. It feels as real as the seat beneath my ass. There are two buttons to click on the tablet. Enter account information or open new account. I click the latter, and I'm taken to a page where I can enter my credit card information. You pay extra for each customized experience. I'd love to know how much, but as they say, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. I used to know my mother's credit card number by heart. Odds are it's changed since the last time I was caught using it. But even if it hasn't, I'm not dumb enough to let the company know I've got the glasses. I return to the main menu and choose Dame Judy instead. In an instant, she's sitting beside me, wearing the same sparkling evening gown she had on in the company's boardroom. There's a menu icon in the upper right corner of my field of vision. I open it up and scroll through it. Dame Judy's outfit cycles through hundreds of choices, most of which I doubt you'd find in her home closet. I choose a tasteful ensemble that benefits a woman of her stature, a white rhinestone suit, and a pink cowboy hat. Hi, I say, reaching out a hand.
Hello,
she responds with a coy smile. When she shakes my hand, her grip is surprisingly firm.
What sort of experience may I offer you today?
It's clear I could ask for anything. That's the whole point. And what would be wrong with that? It's Dame Judy's voice and Dame Judy's face, but it's not Dame Judy. Is it? I'm starting to feel very unwell. This is not right, but I don't know how to describe what's wrong. If someone were to lean over and kiss her, no harm would come to the flesh and blood woman. It's highly unlikely she'd ever know. What would be the difference between kissing her in Other Earth and daydreaming about it?
Don't be shy, she says,
placing a hand on my shoulder. I feel the heat radiating from her palm. One of her veins throb as her heart sends blood to her fingers. A drop of sweat trickles down from my temple. I reach back and fumble for the disc on the back of my skull. Relief floods over me when I feel it. I rip it off along with the glasses and toss them onto the seat beside me. I look at them there, where Dame Judy was just sitting, and wonder, which is worse, Other World or Other Earth? The Kiss. When I reach our suite at the Waldorf Astoria, I drop down on one of the silk-upholstered sofas and close my eyes. It's so quiet and peaceful that I almost feel sane. I've started thinking of the hotel as home, but I don't know how long we'll be able to stay. In retrospect, I probably should have pulled a few more bundles of bills out of the duffel bag. The money from the Phantom will be running out soon, and I doubt Alexei Semenov's estate will continue to foot our hotel bills. I open my eyes and see a silhouette in the shape of Bussara standing in the doorway of the room where Katz and Elvis's bodies are laid out on identical full-size beds while their minds are in Other World. When Bussara steps forward into the light, I can tell she's staring at me. What? I demand. God, she gets on my nerves.
Simon, are you okay? She asks. Where's your ogre friend?
He's safe now. I took him home to New Jersey. I'm almost regretting the decision now. I could really use Gorog's company. For some reason, Busara makes me angry and anxious. I've never really been able to trust her. At least I knew Gorog always had my back. Plus, the kid was a riot. I don't think Busara has ever told a joke in her life.
What happened? She asks.
It's hard to know where to begin. I point to the black box I set down on the coffee table next to the sofa. That's Other Earth, I tell her. I tried it.
She gasps. You what? Simon, do you have any idea?
I cut her off. I don't give a damn what she thinks. Yes, I do. I'm not interested in a lecture, Busara. I knew exactly how stupid it was before I did it. Now, do you want to hear about my experience or not?
I do, she says with a sigh.
Yeah, I thought so. I start with the destruction of Manhattan and end with Dame Judi Dench.
With the disc on, how did Other Earth compare to Other World? Busara asks.
Was it just as convincing? There was no way to tell what was real and what wasn't. I could feel the lady sitting next to me. Hell, I could smell her perfume. For the record, Judi Dench smells fucking great.
Do you think it's as dangerous as Otherworld?
Nothing's as dangerous as Otherworld, but Other Earth has a pretty impressive body count, too. I reach for the box and pull out the post-it inside. Alexei gave me 5 names. He was convinced they were all people who were given Other Earth glasses and a disc. All but one of them are dead now. We need to find proof that Wayne and his buddies were responsible. It's our best chance now to destroy the company. You and I should start working on a plan right away. She peers down at me with a strange expression.
I think we should wait for Elvis and Kat to get back from Otherworld.
No! I bang my fist on the coffee table with far more force than I should. Busara doesn't even flinch. I swear, she's a goddamn robot. It can't wait. Did you hear what I told you? People are dying. We have to come up with something now.
I don't think that we can, Simon. Have you seen yourself lately?
When I don't answer immediately, she points to the bathroom.
Get up right now and go look in the mirror.
I don't know why I do what she tells me. I guess I'm just too tired to resist. The bathroom light was designed to be flattering, but even its golden glow can't hide the truth. I'm pale and sickly, with dark circles around my eyes. I look like a bad photocopy of myself. I might not even recognize my reflection if it weren't for the Gloria Schnoz.
I think you should get some sleep right away, Busara tells me. We can talk about all of this as soon as you're up.
It's excellent advice, I suppose, but I can't shake the feeling she's stalling. My sleep is deep and dreamless, but I wake up with a start just after 2 a.m. The suite is dark and no one is stirring. I wander into the living room where I find the remains of a room service meal on a wheeled cart. My stomach growls noisily. I can't even recall the last time I ate. I lift one of the metal domes, hoping for leftovers. Perched on a bed of wilted lettuce is an iridescent green scorpion. I jump back just in time to avoid a lash from the barb at the end of its tail. Then it scuttles off the tray and disappears under one of the sofas. I pinch my eyes shut and breathe in deeply. I can hear the rush of blood pumping through my veins.
It wasn't real, I whisper.
But I'm not convinced. It looked as real as Dame Judi Dench. I hurry to the bedroom where Kat and Elvis are laid out on the beds and close the door, stuffing a towel in the crack beneath it to keep the scorpion out. After that, there's nothing else to do but drop down in the plush chair in the corner. I'm reminded of the days I spent sleeping in the chair beside Kat's hospital bed. But this time, we're not alone. Busara is sleeping on Elvis's bed, which seems a little unusual. But I suppose she wants to stay close in case she needs to remove the discs. It's the first time Elvis and Kat have gone under without me. I watch their bodies for clues that might tell me where they are in Otherworld. The discs include the same kind of paralysis that keeps people from acting out our dreams while we sleep. Elvis mumbles something incomprehensible. Then Kat cries out once as if she might be injured. I hop out of my chair ready to rip off the disc at the first sign of trouble. But I know she'll be pissed if I drag her out of Otherworld before they've killed off the guests. So I put my ear to her chest and listen to her racing heart. After a few seconds, It slows down. I suppose most people would be bored to death by this vigil, but the sound of Cat's heart, when it's slow and steady, is the most beautiful music I've ever heard. I hope it can help me recover what little is left of my mind. I am not well at all. I know that. I don't want to end up raving at the padded walls inside an asylum. But what scares me most is the thought of losing Cat. I spent 10 years of my life dreaming about her. Now we've been together for a little more than a week, and I'm already falling apart.
Psst! It comes from the bathroom.
Simon.
I know who it is, and though his presence is hardly proof that my sanity's been restored, I'm glad he's here. If nothing else, I should apologize for trying to murder him in Otherworld. I get up, turn the light on in the bathroom, and softly close the door behind me. Hey there, I say to the Kishka, who's perched on the fancy toilet seat. Sorry for throwing a dagger at you before. He bats away my apology with a flick of his hand.
Not a problem. It's all part of the job. Well, listen, kid. There's a question I've been meaning to ask you.
He pauses to light a cigarette. Pale blue smoke spills out of it and swirls around us like fog in a Halloween haunted house. Okay, I'm getting impatient.
What is it? Do you know who I really am?
It's a bizarre question coming from someone I've been chatting with regularly. Sure, you're the Kishka. I figure it's best to play along. You're my dead grandfather who visits me because I'm mentally unsound. The Kishka shakes his head at me as if to imply that I'm stupid as well as insane. He taps the giant nose that earned him the nickname, the schnoz that's almost identical to mine.
I'm the part of you that never changes. No matter what happens or how damaged you get, I'll always be the same. It's like your mother. She had the beautiful nose I gave her shaved down and shaped, but I swear, it's still there, every time she looks in the mirror.
I laugh. You sure about that? I have my doubts. I think my mother sees the same perfect nose everyone else sees.
Why don't you ask her?
The Kishka says.
She'd probably be happy to hear from you. Maybe she can remind you who you are.
There you have it. I've gone stark raving mad, I respond. I'm sure Mom's thrilled to be rid of me.
Who knows? I'd say it's worth a gamble, he says. These days things aren't exactly what they seem. In fact,
he stops and cocks his head toward the bedroom.
Wake up,
he orders me.
Now!
I open my eyes and discover I've fallen asleep in the chair. I sense someone moving inside the room. As my eyes adjust, I see that Busara has gotten up and walked over to Elvis's side of the bed. She's leaning over his body. Maybe he did something that alarmed her? Or maybe she's trying to figure out where he and Cat are in Otherworld? Then, I see Busara take one of his hands in her own. I assume she's about to check his pulse, but then she leans down and plants a kiss on his forehead, right above his visor. It isn't some friendly peck, either. It's a real kiss, if I've ever seen one. I must gasp, because Busara spins around. She knows she's been caught in the act. I close my eyes and let loose an unconvincing snore. She tiptoes over to my chair, and I can feel her leaning over me. I'm hoping like hell she doesn't kiss me, too. It's all so weird that I'm relieved when she just stands there, as if waiting for a sign.
It's very important that you not tell anyone what you think you just saw, Busara whispers.
I must be a better actor than I thought. She's not completely sure I'm awake. She can count on me. I won't say a word. At this point, I'm not completely certain what just happened was real, but I hope it was, even though it will cost me $100. Because unless I've completely lost my mind, Busara loves Elvis, too. The bigger question, though, is why the Kishka thought I should see it.
The diamond. I'm up with the sun,
While Busara sleeps, I order room service and chow down 3 orders of bacon and pancakes. I'm feeling better than I have in days when I leave the Waldorf Astoria and hunt down a sidewalk Wi-Fi kiosk a safe distance away. I plug in my headphones and punch a number into the telephone keypad.